Hello and welcome to 251, two pianists, five questions, one guest. This is the second in our series of interviews with people who are influential on the UK jazz scene. Our first was with Steve Ruby of the 606 Club, and we conducted that over the internet due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But now we're allowed out again. We went to a different jazz club. You can find all our podcasts on our Buzzsprout feed or on your usual podcast providers. My name's Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin. And I'm sitting here in Ronnie Scott's jazz club with Mr. Paul Pace. So, Paul, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your early days involved in the jazz scene, and particularly Spice Jazz, and how you became involved with that, really.
Well, going back to the very beginning, I was bitten by the jazz bug. It was my domestic experience with the Glenn Miller story on the family TV, and it was the strains of Tuxedo Junction with the trombones going boop-bop, boop-bop, the wah-wah sound that got to me, and I felt this sort of warm glow over my body, and I was living in Croydon at the time, in South Croydon, and it was quite near to Fairfield Halls. But that time I was taping stuff off the radio. There was a show called Big Band Era by Alan Dell, and Benny Green had a program as well later on. But I was actually learning a lot about the music from the radio. And I would occasionally go to Fairfield Halls from my late teens onwards, when we had big bands coming in like Woody Herman, Buddy Rich, Tommy Dorsey Ghost Band. I got to see Harry James with Sonny Payne, Count Basie. An amazing array of bands. I'm actually on the recording of Stan Kenton today in the audience applauding, so I feel quite proud of that. And then I went up to London to study architecture at UCL, University College London, at the Bartlett School of Architecture. Did my degree there, and of course that was very close to Ronnie Scott's, but I had actually been to Ronnie Scott's when I was at school in 72 to see Zoot Sims, mm-hmm. and then to see Stefan Grappelli and so on. But our first visit there as schoolboys was truncated because there was a queue round the block waiting to see Sonny Rollins, who had just come out of one of his retirements. And that was in 72. Mm-hmm. We got there too late. We didn't realise we had to book in advance. So that was fun. So when I was at college, I got to see lots of groups at Ronnie's, but I also went to all the other grassroots venues around London, mm-hmm. all the pubs that were putting on jazz. There was a fantastic pub jazz scene there. And then when I graduated, I was living in Maida Vale, about 5 minutes walk away from Maida Vale Studios, where they used to record Jazz Club every Tuesday. And I got to see everybody on the scene, from Stan Tracy through to Harry Beckett, Alexis Corner, all these people. It was just incredible. So somehow by osmosis or organically, I've got involved with the scene. And at that point, there were a lot of jazz musicians living in that area in Maida Vale. They now moved to East London, and later sort of moved further east. Mm. But in those days, it was rife with people like Frank Roberts and Simon Moser, who were they used to jam around each other's house, and I was party to that as well as seeing them at various venues. So that was my baptism of fire with jazz. And as a host and as a performer, that came about when I moved to East London, and a girlfriend at the time said, "Oh, you have quite a nice singing voice." I was just singing along to the records. I was heavily collecting records at that time and sang along. And at that point, and I was always trying to learn an instrument, like the trumpet particularly, but maybe piano and so on. Never got it down, as it were, like you chaps. I started going to vocal workshops, one led by Mary Fagan in Hoxton Hall, and then I had a one-to-one with Claire Martin for over a period of 2 years. And by that time, I was hosting a session in a pub in East London called the Rose and Crown in Mare Street, and this was the upper room, so that was every Friday. So I was the host and the singer, and I got together friends who played. A couple of them actually lived where I in the same block as me in East London. And then I had people like Alan Barnes who came along, and Ian Hunter, the guitarist, and it was quite glorious. But somehow it came to an end. But gigs in pubs depend on bums on seats and bar sales.
Yeah.
I think we did okay, but there were lots of other promoters who came along, indie bands and so on, that pulled in family and friends, and it was hard to compete with that. But they were good sessions. Then I started performing and also hosting sessions in other rooms around London. And it was Nick Home, who was running a session at the Baker and Oven in Marylebone, who got in touch with me about doing a singer's night there, because I'd been involved also with the Jazz Bistro as well, in Farringdon Road. That was the Jazz...
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, Jazz Singers Network. Yeah, you may have played there, Nick.
Yeah.
James Pearson was down there with his trio, with Matt Skelton and Jeremy Brown, all these people that were playing down there. But that was an interesting time, very, very vibrant time. So for 13 months, I think, we ran sessions at the Baker and Oven, and then that was about to become a restaurant, and it went a bit corporate. The new manager came in. He brought in a singer-songwriter's night that was where they had a free door, and it was hard to compete with that, so because I was charging on the door. So he said, why don't you have a free door, and we'll pay you a percentage from the bar, you know. And I said, well, that's not going to work. Everybody's going to end up with £8 each at the end of the night. So I left there and I looked around for a suitable room to put on live jazz, and that was the spice of life. That was indicated to me. It was a basement room in a loose-fit Victorian pub just off Cambridge Circus, and it was pointed out to me by a market trader in Dover Street. He said, oh, try that pub over there. They've got a lovely room. And I went there, met the manager who lived there with his family, Irish manager, and... he said, oh, yeah, okay, I love the music, you know, if you want to do something down there. So I started doing singers' nights. They didn't have a music license. In those days, we're talking about 1998, there was, you could only have two musicians at any one time
playing. Yeah, two in the bar.
That's right, two in the bar.
I remember it well, yeah.
I remember Hames Birchall working very hard to try and change that. He did tremendous work on that. And eventually, what we did there was successful enough to merit getting a music license. So there was an area manager who was quite enlightened, and she came along, and we got a piano, got an upright piano, and we were able to have groups in there. And that was my dream, and that was something inspired by going to Ronnie Scott's and seeing Cedar Walton Trio, for example, and seeing Billy Higgins away, smiled away, and related to David Williams on bass, and Bob Berg in the front, and Cedar Walton. That kind of interaction in a well-melded jazz rhythm section, and that excited me. That, and trying to create that rather than two musicians playing duo all night, which is great for, in my opinion, for 20 minutes.
Then
it starts to pull.
Unless it's Stan Getz and Kenny Barron, of course.
Absolutely. You've got a very good point there. Yeah, those are tremendous recordings. That's right. Absolutely.
So our first question was, could you tell us about the history of Spice Jazz and how did it come about? What were the early days like? Our second question to Paul was, what is your involvement with the club now? And what are some of the challenges involved in running a jazz club at this time?
Yeah, so Spice Jazz is still going. It's still happening.
Yes,
and what's your involvement now? Is it? Are you still as involved in Spice Jazz? Or
I not as much in a way, because, I mean, I'm still a senior member of the team, but I brought a... on board, and it was Clement Rieger, called Clement Rieger in English, French guitarist, who came along to lots of sessions there, particularly the Vando Jam sessions we had, that were sponsored by Vandorum, the reed manufacturer. So he came along to those as a jammer, and lots of musicians have passed through the Spice over the years, who've then become names. I mean, there's a whole list of people, but Clement approached me and said, it'd be a shame for you to walk away from this. And I didn't want to walk away and just leave it, and then someone else comes in and puts something, in my eyes, inferior to what we've created there, created in terms of the legacy. So it's me, Clement, and then we have Tara Minton, a harpist and singer, who's joined us recently. And previously it was Joanna Bernhardt, who was working with us for a year, and Alex Weston King, who shadowed me. But prior to that, it was pretty much a one-man band. I had one or two people helping over the years. But the idea is to have a committee so we share the load between us, the workload, and also we get some funding. We've tried once, but we now have learned from that experience to try again with the Arts Council to see if we can get some funding to provide money for guarantees for musicians and also for PR as well. So that's the way forward at the moment. I'm still involved in that sense, and making sure that the programming is reasonable and you know, varied, that it doesn't become cliques. Yeah. I fear that happens with other venues where people book mates and so on. I think the idea also is the idea was to reflect the diversity of the scene.
Yeah.
I remember hearing some, there's a Dutch trad band, or sort of trad, early
band. I think it was, maybe it was a Norwegian band, was it? It Norwegian was Martin Jarl Velsen.
Yes.
Okay, they were in their straw boaters, and they were tremendous. Also, yeah.
And yeah. So that was, when I was working on Downton Abbey, the band who I put together to be on screen, people like Nick Ball, from, they're all sort of Mendham, Alex Mendham orchestra people.
Oh, right.
And they said, "Oh, come down and hear these guys. They're really amazing."
Yeah.
And that was a different day, wasn't it? Was it a Wednesday afternoon?
I know that you're referring to the other night, the Spice of Life Jazz Club, the that had on the Wednesday lunchtimes.
Was that Wednesday?
That's right. There was another promoter who came in, did the Carl Shorten Jazz Club, and that was,
So that was
David Burr.
That
wasn't mine. But I have put on similar bands, but yeah, they do, you know, a good job there on those Wednesday lunchtimes. And, they came a couple of years after I'd started the jazz night at the Spice. But
because once a place gets a name for having music on, it kind of attracts, it's a honeypot, isn't it?
It is.
Other things, that's great for building a scene, you know.
It is, yeah, it is. Yeah. It's you've just got to be a little bit careful about splitting audiences. You know, I'm very aware of saleability of certain acts, of what you create, that you know, you don't tread on other people's toes. We have in the Soho, of course, three or four venues, you know, they put on in jazz in a serious way. Of course, Ronnie's is the top of the heap.
Mm.
Pizza Express, Spice of Life. Mm. There is Jazz After Dark, which is a good sort of beginning space, I suppose, for people coming straight from college and so on.
Well, Nick and I do gigs, you know, there's plenty of other gigs going on in sort of old Compton Street, little duos here and there, aren't they? Mm. You do that. Who's the singer you
with? There's a gig I do at Trish's, you know. Do you know
Trish's? I know Trish's, that's a great place.
That's a proper old Soho sort of drinking club.
That's right.
So there are still these places around, aren't
there? Yes, there are, that's right. Yeah. You know, Cafe Boheme, of course, in there putting on gigs again. One or two. Oh, Piano Bar, of course, near the Pizza Express.
I do Swift.
Yeah.
The Swift Bar around the corner. All right,
brilliant.
Yeah, it's good that there's still a scene, even though it's obviously very different, but it's still happening.
Sure.
Nick and I were very grateful that Paul Pace agreed to talk to us, and we were sitting in the green room behind the main stage of Ronnie Scott's, the famous jazz club. So I asked him the question, how did you become involved in Ronnie Scott's jazz club?
I became involved because I knew Simon Cook, who unfortunately is no longer managing director here, but we had Leo Green, who took over when Sally Green and Michael Watt bought the business from Pete King,
who
used to, you know, founded the club with Ronnie Scott, and that was in 2005 they did that, and the club reopened 2006, and then we had Leo Green as managing director for a couple of years, and then Simon Cook took over in 2008, and I joined in 2009. But I had worked for him previously. I knew him through a friend who introduced me to him, but he actually came down to the Bakery and Oven to see me introducing the band, and then booked me as the coordinator for the other shows at the Waldorf. He was running music for Jazz FM, the live music scene. So he did Smolensky's and the Waldorf Hotel, and I used to go there and make sure that the band were on stage on time, introduce the band and do all the bits and pieces around the performance. So he knew me from that, and we'd become friends. He also knew me as well at Ray's Jazz, because I worked in the Ray's Jazz record shop, the old one in Shaftesbury Avenue, and then I brought the shop into Foyles, and that was in 2002, and I was manager there for 6 years. So I was running the Spice at that time. We were doing in-store events in the club, in the shop as well. And Simon knew me from all of that and thought he might. And when I was made redundant from Foyles, I made it known on the jazz scene that I was available, and I bumped into Simon in the street just coincidentally, and then he told me he'd be made managing director at Ronnie's, and I congratulated him, and then he gave me a call a couple of weeks later. Someone was leaving the staff of Ronnie Scott's, person who did the contracts and so on, and he said, would you be interested? So I think I thought about it for a
nanoseconds.
Less than.
I remember I remember you being at the old Ray's Jazz Shop. That was a real little gem, wasn't it?
It was. I remember you coming in. We had some nice conversations. Yeah.
That's when I lived in the House of Jazz with Dominic Howells and Jamie O'Donnell and Gareth McLean.
They're all fantastic musicians. They're lovely people as well. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a great shame when that went, actually, wasn't it?
It was like being at a party every day. I mean, the managers, it was strange because I went there and as a customer, and I'd handed my CV in, and I was struggling with freelance work to do with architecture and graphics. You know, things were coming in dribs and drabs, you know, no continuous work. And then one day I went in to spend my small fortune on records, and they called me behind the bar and they said, the two managers have booked the holiday at the same time. They weren't particularly communicating with each other well, and we might have a part-time job for you. So that's how I got the job. And
So that was Glyn and
Yeah, Glyn Callum, that's right. Glyn Callum and Mike Gavin.
Oh,
Mike Gavin did
work
the Folk and Roots downstairs. He was a manager there, and Glyn did the jazz upstairs. Yeah. And Ray would come in. Ray Smith would come in and...
The original Ray.
That's it. The Ray of Sunshine. So Ray was there. And Bob Glasswell was the other very nice man who unfortunately passed away, I think, in 2001. Mm. But he was a soft underbelly of the team there, because it was formidable. You know, you went into Mole Jazz and Ray's Jazz and this kind of scene. If you weren't used to their personalities, it was quite a wall to get through.
Yeah,
and you'd be told off if you picked the wrong record. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you watch the scene from Fidelity?
High Fidelity.
Yeah. Where a customer is hauled over the coals for requesting Happy Birthday by Stevie Wonder, I think.
Yes.
It's not far off that, you know, through digital jazz specialist record shop. Dobell's was very similar as well. That was quite a daunting prospect to go there.
Mm.
So
I think it helped if you were a musician.
Yes.
I think if you actually played, then you got a bit more of a favourable reception.
That's right, yeah.
I do remember the with all the records in their sort of, what would you call them, bins?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
There was one called Rare as Hen's Teeth, which always used to make me laugh.
Oh, that was great. That was, and some of those had records with no sleeves, no covers, sorry. Mm. And these were Jackie had his own. Jackie Doherty, legendary on the scene, had his own little rack, and that was called Jackie's Bag.
Yes, Jackie's Bag.
And Jackie was, his method was to put the albums onto cassettes and then sell back the records and keep the sleeves. So,
and of course, Jackie became, is he still involved in Spice Jazz?
Yes, in fact, he's a very important part of Spice Jazz. He, Jackie, I was very fortunate and unfortunate in some respects, because he has a manner about him, which, again, is an acquired taste sometimes. But Jackie Doherty did the door at Spice of Life, at Spice Jazz, and there was maybe a misdemeanour or a misunderstanding about using a colourful term within earshot of a customer that cost him his job there. So,
oh, I see.
And that wasn't me, that was the manager who purveyed that news. But Jackie was, and he does come down, and he's a brilliant guy and very, very generous, very generous spirited man who gives out cassettes and CDs now.
I've got a pile of
absolutely.
CDs
and DVDs, tapes, etc. So he's dispensed the message of jazz.
Well, you know when you've arrived as a musician when you get a tape from Jackie. He's known as Jackie the Tape, isn't he?
Absolutely. No, he's incredible. I mean, he's 83 now, but he's got the energy of a 12-and-a-half-year-old.
Yeah.
He's
an
incredible man. Yeah.
We were interested to know what Paul's daily job at Ronnie Scott's involved. So Nick asked our fourth question.
So just to talk a little bit about your work at Ronnie's, what does it really involve kind of on a day-to-day basis, really?
I'm part of the music team, so there are four of us now. There were five. And so it's Fred Nash is now, who's general manager, is now the manager of the club. And so the buck stops with him. Whenever we discuss things, he'll say, yes, we'll put that one in. And so it's myself and Sarah Weller and James Pearson, who are the people discussing the bookings for the club, so that's quite a privileged position to be in, and it's negotiating and navigating all the whys and wherefores of proposals, as well as chasing bands that we feel would work well in Ronnie's. And yeah, prior to coming to the club to work here, I was obviously aware of the legacy and saw Ronnie Scott many times, but also all the great bands that played in here. So it's trying to keep that level of excellence and also expressing the diversity of the scene, which obviously I was trying to do at the Spice of Life as well. So I do that, and I negotiate with agents and musicians, and there's a fair bit of admin involved with that as well. I have free rein to book the Sunday lunches, as well as doing the main room, and also upstairs. We're actually doing some interesting things upstairs with guitar duos duos and solo performances, since we had the social distancing restrictions, but we're going to expand that as well. So all sorts of things. And I also go abroad. I don't know how easy it is now, but been to many European festivals, and the Europe Jazz Network, for example, hold a conference each year. So I've been to a couple of those. We've got one in Tallinn in mid-September. So I'm looking forward to that. So I meet fellow festival directors and promoters.
Does that bring leads? Do you find that brings leads for bands?
It does, absolutely. You know, and part of the connection particularly has been with Norway, you know, where the scene has been very well funded compared to this country, of course, and Holland, Netherlands. And bringing over the likes of Pixel and Trondheim Jazz Orchestra and things like that, you know, just it'd be quite amazing. So I hope to continue those connections despite Brexit.
Our final question was, could you reflect on the jazz scene in the UK today? What do you feel are the changes it faces, and how do you see the future?
My last question was really just going to be, inviting you really just to reflect on, I suppose, the jazz scene as it is today, particularly in the UK. I mean, we've had, as you mentioned, Brexit. We've had the coronavirus as well as a sort of another challenge. I mean, how do you see the UK jazz scene at the moment, you know? Are you kind of optimistic about it? You know, do you feel that it's kind of thriving, or what do you think?
I think musically speaking, it is thriving. I think you've got a tremendous range of styles at the same time. I suppose this is happening in jazz anyway. You know, it's no longer this is a bebop era, post-bop, etc. I mean, there is the movement that is talked about and written about is a, you know, from just to put it very simply, is the spiritual jazz Afrobeat funk scene that I suppose exemplified by the likes of Moses Boyd and Ezra Collective, Nabaya Garcia, Shabaka Hutchins, all those people.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's a fantastic scene, and this has media interest, which can't be a bad thing. It's very good, and there's been some good stuff on mainstream TV about that. But there are also other scenes that get a bit neglected. The mainstream scene, which includes some of the straight ahead players, the Steve Fishwicks, Dominic Howes, we spoke about earlier, and so Nick Tomlin and Sonny Whiteside. So the straight ahead scene tends not to have that attention.
No.
And then you've got the, I mean, Kansas Smithies is sort of swing era music updated. The likes of Joe Webb and Giacomo Smith and people like that. An amazing scene and very popular. So, and then there's a more experimental scene with Laura Jurd and you know, Chaos Collective. We had them in, for example, as a residency for a year in the Spice of Life, as well as the Tomorrow's Warriors. And Tomorrow's Warriors has spawned the first scene I spoke about. So there's all these things nurturing. Then you've got people coming out of college, Matt Roberts and Phil Meadows. Jasmine Davis, of course, you know, some fantastic players. Younger players like Poppy Daniels and Rosie Freighter Taylor. So, musically speaking, it's a very vibrant and fertile area. The only problem, the issue, I think, is the audience. It's getting audience to the other scenes that are not so well nurtured by the media. You know, the word's not getting out there. What fantastic musicians are about and present. And also presentation from the musicians themselves, actually being able to put on a show, I think, is, as a promoter, with my promoter's hat on, you've got three groups to look after. You've got the people who run the venue, that they make enough money to stay in business. Bar sales, bums on seats, of course. The audience, and I think the audience is what I'm going to talk about in a moment, and then the musicians. And not necessarily in that order, but they all depend on each other. And I think that the audience is the most crucial thing, because that's where, you know, if we're talking
revenue,
exactly, exactly the word I was going to use for it all to happen. And when I started the Spice, I was keen that we kept it all separate from any funding or any subsidy from the bar, just to make it work on its own merits. And unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way. You know, you get audiences of 20 one night, you know, eight another night. 100 another night, you know, it's so variable.
Inconsistent. Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard to carry on revenue from one gig to another, you know, to build up a pot. And I'm going along with the funding applications and so on at the moment, because I think that's how we can make it work, I suppose, in this current climate.
Kind of give a seed bed out of which the other things can grow.
That's right. But of course, you have to fill certain criteria. And that's that. It starts to put constraints on your booking policy. And I've always been aware of diversity in the music, and for me, the gender diversity is quite crucial in particularly instrumentalists as well. You know, there are lots of female vocalists for a start, and I think that's starting to change. You get people like Jazz Kaiser and Poppy Daniels and coming through. And that's a great thing. So. I think the machismo in the music, which it suffered from many decades, is now changing. So that I'm very pleased about that.
Yeah, that's definitely something I've noticed. I mean, I've known Josephine for, well, she actually was another inmate briefly in
the House of Jazz.
Yeah, because she was at that time. I think she was Gareth LeGrain's girlfriend, and likewise, vice versa. But. Yeah, really, she's been good since then. But it's just only in the last few years that her star has properly risen, I think.
I agree.
Was she at Guildhall? I think she graduated.
Yeah, she was at Guildhall, that's right.
From the Guildhall so, but it is good to see that people like Laura, Jer, Tori Freestone, those sorts of players are starting to properly be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, you know, there obviously there are other diverse issues that people have addressed, but I feel that jazz has not been guilty of any bar in that respect. You know, I mean, at Ronnie's and other jazz venues, the doors have always been open. I don't feel it's been criticism levelled at certain venues. I won't go into detail, but I feel that the gender issue for me is the one to address in the sense that you don't want young women to feel they can't enter the scene. That it's completely open and it's talent that rises to the top.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think that probably wraps things up, unless you've got any other questions, Simon.
I think that's great. And thanks very much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. So, I mean, lots more to talk about, of course. I mean, maybe. The legacy of the people that
we can always do another one.
We can do that.
In 6 months' time or something.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Paul.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We'll let you get off to your day job now.
Thanks, Simon.
Bye.
We'd like to thank Paul Pace for spending time with us. We had a great time talking to him about his life in jazz in London, his involvement with Spice Jazz, Ray's Jazz Shop, the move to Foyles, and his now involvement in Ronnie Scott's as the coordinator as part of the music team. If you're interested in listening to more of our podcasts, you can find them all in one place on our Buzzsprout feed, and that's in the link in the notes. But also you can subscribe through Apple Music, Spotify, those sorts of platforms. We put out a 5-minute podcast every 2 weeks on a small subject to do with jazz. And we also have some longer 5-part series where we look at pianists in more detail. We've done Sonny Clark so far and Kenny Drew, and we're working on one on Hampton Hawes. Thanks a lot to Nick, who put this all together and got Paul to agree to the interview. So from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And my name's Nick Tomlin. Goodbye.